regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Brandon Combs from the Firearms Policy Coalition here in just a moment or two about a case out of the Fifth Circuit in Louisiana, Reese versus ATF. This is a challenge to the federal ban on handgun sales to adults 18, 19, and 20 years old. FPC, along with the Second Amendment Foundation, Louisiana Shooting Association, and the individual plaintiffs in this case, won this challenge, at least at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. But the judgment that has been entered by the U.S. District Judge, the trial judge in this case, essentially nullifies that decision. Because even though the judge says this law is unconstitutional, it can still be enforced against pretty much every 18, 19, and 20-year-old, not only across the country, but specifically within the 5th District Court of Appeals jurisdiction. It is disappointing, to say the least. Thankfully, FPC and SAF say that they are not done with this fight. Take a look and a listen. Brandon, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
It's good to see you.
I wish we were talking about a different outcome here in Reese versus ATF. This is so weird. All right. So the background of this case, 5 years ago, right? FPC, Louisiana Shooting Association, and SAF filed this federal lawsuit challenging the ban on handgun sales to adults between the ages of 18 and 20, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Then a district judge comes back and dismisses that case. I think it was in 2022. During the Biden administration, taking the position that 18 to 20 year olds should essentially have no right to purchase a handgun. The judge agrees. This case gets appealed up to the Fifth Circuit. Fifth Circuit reverses that decision and says, "Oh no, 18 to 20 year olds they are vested with their Second Amendment rights." Correct?
Yeah, that's right. The Fifth Circuit definitely came out strongly and unequivocally and said, look, this class of persons is protected. This is part of the people in the Constitution. And the Fifth Circuit, notably for this case, the Fifth Circuit understood that we were suing on behalf of our members. It said so pretty explicitly in the opinion. These organizations filed on behalf of their members. So, yeah, that's exactly where we're at.
Okay, so this case then goes back down to the judge who originally threw out the case. Two sides are supposed to get together and kind of flesh out the scope of the judgment, right? And I guess the plaintiffs and the defendants unable to reach an agreement, right, as to how broad this judgment should be. So the government, and now we're getting into 2025. Now we're getting into the Trump administration. The DOJ, I believe it was back in March, filed this motion for judgment that would limit relief to the named plaintiffs, as well as individuals who belong to SAF, FPC, Louisiana Shooting Association. But you all would have to identify those individuals, right?
So the government basically, the government's position has been with respect to this case, you have to say who was a member when the case was filed, right? That's who it applies to. And you got to tell us, and you have to tell us who your members are. That's the government's position. If you want them to be covered, that we have to know who they are so that we can adjust our enforcement practices. Obviously, we didn't agree to that. We wouldn't agree to that. And so, you know, we've had this sort of drawn out dispute over what the judgment should look like. We had proposed a judgment very, very consistent with, virtually every other case these days to say it has to cover at least these people. And they obviously disagreed. I think this is really part of the government's broader strategy with respect to relief, which, you know, we can all quibble with and certainly disagree with. But I do think that for whatever it's worth, that is what they're doing here is saying like, look, you know, if you're not part of a class action, if you're not a certified class, then we're only going to recognize relief with respect to the people that are named as a party. And our position is, well, we are named as a party. It's Firearms Policy Coalition. It's Second Amendment Foundation, right? So these are named parties, for example. And case law on this is very clear. The binding Supreme Court precedent says that associations, such as we are, associations can sue on behalf of their members and get relief on behalf of their members. It doesn't say, well, but only as of the date that you file or only if you turn over your membership list or something silly like that. That's not what the Supreme Court has said repeatedly. So I think it's, you know, our position has been and remains, look, it's your choice. If you want to, you know, if you want to continue enforcing the law or try to, you know, that's sort of on you. If you want to say, hey, you know what, a federal court has said this is unconstitutional, we're going to stop enforcing it for everybody, they have a right to do that. You know, they could do that, but they haven't. And I don't think that they're going to.
Which is, I mean, you know, and so, yeah, so we get to the point where the judge basically adopts the DOJ's position yesterday. And the scope of this relief applies to, again, the individual plaintiffs, those FPC, LSA, and SAF members who, as you say, were members at the time this lawsuit was filed 5 years ago, right, who are now between the ages of 18 and 20. So I think it was the FPC statement who pointed out, you're talking about members who were 13 years old when this lawsuit was filed, right? Who would not have been a party to this lawsuit because at 13, you don't have a right to buy a firearm. Anyway, that I don't think is in dispute at this point. The relief is also limited to the jurisdiction of the Fifth Circuit. So three states. And even though the judge says this law is unconstitutional, it's essentially in effect across the country for every 18, 19 and 20 year old today. Right.
Indeed, they've essentially nullified, right? They just nullified the value of this Fifth Circuit opinion saying this law is unconstitutional, stop doing it. You know, the Fifth Circuit sent the case back down for this district court judge to essentially finalize the case. It's all we had to do was finalize the case. And yet here we are in yet another dispute because, and the thing about this that people need to understand is that the district court here actually went farther than what the Department of Justice asked for, which was by itself, frankly, insane. The court actually said, you have this much time to turn over your membership list as of this date. The DOJ didn't ask for that. They knew that that would run into First Amendment concerns, right? So I think, you know, even in the DOJ's brief on this subject, they said, well, you know, they could turn it over, but we're not going to require it. You know, we're not saying they have to. We're saying they could, you know, if they wanted to give us a list of people that this would apply to. And in any event, so the court, the district court here actually went farther than what the DOJ asked for and said, well, you have, you know, this much time to turn over your list to the defendants, which, of course, everybody, I think, reacted instantly and said, no, that's not happening. And it's not required. I mean, you can take a membership card into a dealer and show your, you know, any, you know, whatever organization you're a member of, provided they're a party to this case, you should be able to just show your membership card and say, okay, well, here's my proof, right? Here's a copy. Put it alongside the 4473 or what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. The ATF could tailor, you know, its enforcement practices here very easily, as we pointed out in our briefing. But again, I think that they're sort of dug in. And I don't think, for whatever it's worth, this is about exclusively Second Amendment remedies. I think that the government's position is, broadly speaking, you know, for all cases of all types, this is kind of what they're doing.
Yeah. And I suspect that's right. But I wrote about this at Variant Arms today. It still runs counter to what President Trump wrote in his Second Amendment executive order, which was that the DOJ should look at the positions that the government has been taking in these cases and, again, apply a standard that respects the Second Amendment. You've got a decision here that says this law violates the Second Amendment, and you've got the DOJ saying, well, we want to limit this decision as much as possible. To me, that I mean, there's a pretty clear conflict there. And what's really distressing is, yeah, I know that the DOJ Civil Rights Division at least had a hand in writing that the terms of the judgment that they wanted to see. And, you know, this is the same division that is taking historic steps to defend the Second Amendment, right? They've argued against Illinois' ban on AR-15s and large capacity magazines before the Seventh Circuit. They're suing the LA Sheriff's Department over delays in concealed carry licenses. And then we see this, and it's just it's perplexing, to say the least.
So I might look at this slightly differently. I think, based on our experience so far, right? I think that there are two DOJs. I think that we saw that during the first Trump administration. I don't think it's the same problem that we saw in the first Trump administration. But I want to point out, like, I really don't see how the Trump administration is sort of doing what it says yet. I don't think that that's necessarily not where their heart is completely, but the Trump administration's position so far is federal gun control is good and constitutional, and state and local gun control is bad and unconstitutional. If you look at every action they take, you know, and I would challenge listeners, go look at their briefs. They pretty consistently say, our stuff is good, their stuff is bad. I think that's kind of where the government's at. And so here, this is a federal gun control law, and they're saying, hey, this is fine. And we're going to defend our, you know, we're going to defend our law. If you look at every single brief that they have filed and every context in a Second Amendment case, it says the same thing. They said the same thing about suppressors. New Jersey's ban as an example, bad. Our suppressor law, good, right? It's fine. They've said the same thing about virtually every single issue, if not every single issue. And so I would just point out, like, I don't think the Trump administration is actually being pro-gun. I think they're being selectively pro-gun. And I think there's a big difference there.
You know, that is absolutely worth pointing out. And the suppressor issue, I think, is a perfect example of this, because the DOJ, and again, this was a Fifth Circuit case, right? This was the Patterson case. Originally came out and said, no, suppressors aren't protected by the Second Amendment. They then kind of clawed that back, but said, okay, yeah, they're protected, but the NFA requirements, the registration requirements, the $200 a tax stamp, that's a modest burden on our right to keep our arms, which of course opens the door for that modest burden to be applied to every Second Amendment protected item, right? Which is a very scary proposition. All right, I don't want to go too far afield here, but so you know, y'all have won this case, Reese versus ATF. You've won, and the DOJ decided not to appeal to the Supreme Court, right? So that case is moving forward. Is it possible to appeal the terms of the judgment?
Yeah, well, I just want to quickly you kind of tee me up here, so I'll take advantage of that. I want to point out they did not petition to the Supreme Court in this case because they knew they would lose. They are doing this is another example of sort of how they're being selective. The cases they are asking the Supreme Court to review are bad cases. Do you remember U.S. versus Rahimi just a couple of just a little bit ago? They are trying to get the Supreme Court to look very strongly at cases that are bad for the Second Amendment, and they are very much not taking good cases to the Supreme Court, because they know either they have to agree with us or they have to likely tee up a loss for themselves. Part of the strategy they're doing here is putting the worst cases at the Supreme Court front and center. But in any event, just to go back to your question, yeah, there's absolutely a way for us to appeal this, and we will. We're working on it right now. The first thing I'm happy to report is that we are going to be asking the government essentially to agree that the court should stay this craziness, this judgment that says you have so long to turn over your membership lists. I think the government's probably going to agree to that because it's just not worth, you know, for them anyway, right? It's probably not worth anything to fight over. So we're hopeful that'll be the first thing that the government will agree to stay there. And then we'll present that to the court and say, hey, look, you know, we clearly need to deal with this, but can you at least hold off on enforcement of this part of your decision while we work this out? Okay. So that'll be the first thing that everybody should see. And then after that, absolutely, we're going to be appealing and addressing this. There's just no way that this is acceptable or even follows binding case law. So
yeah,
we'll be working on it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't the initial complaint a facial challenge? I mean, it didn't just apply to the named plaintiffs and to the organizations, right? It applied across the board, right?
So that's where, I mean, there was an as applied component to it. That was not decided. It didn't need to be, because the court, the Fifth Circuit decided the case facially and said, look, this is just unconstitutional, period. Right. There was an as applied challenge, but it was moot given the facial claim prevailing.
That's even odder then that the scope of this judgment, if this was ruled unconstitutional on its face, like there's no application in which this would be constitutional, that the remedy supplied by the judge is so limited in scope to essentially being nil.
It is very odd, to say the least. concerning challenges. So many things we could say about this. But look, people have a right. The Fifth Circuit very, very clearly said, absolutely, these people have a right. And now we're arguing about, you know, who gets the relief, who gets to, you know, actually take advantage of that. It's sadly something that shouldn't be a fight today. It really should just be a very straightforward thing that says all of these people get to exercise their rights. And yet here we are.
Yeah. And the Supreme Court will have a chance to consider this issue, right? Because this is one of several lawsuits. You've got a couple of cases out of the Fourth Circuit that I guess pending review by the Supreme Court. There's NRA versus Glass, which challenges Florida's ban. Florida Attorney General James Othmeyer has declined to defend that ban on gun sales to 18 to 20 year olds. So we'll see what happens there. But even if the DOJ doesn't want this particular case to go before the Supreme Court, I don't think they can duck the issue entirely. Whether the court wants to take up this issue, I guess, is another question, but they'll get the opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are certainly cases that are there or heading that way. And I think that this is, you know, at this point, what I would say is this is no longer about whether the people have the right that we claim. They clearly do. That's pretty much done. The real question now is who gets to access it? And, you know, how do we achieve that relief? You know, our view is this is pretty straightforward. The ATF could just stop enforcing. There's nothing that requires the ATF to enforce this law other than their choice, right? They could say, hey, the Fifth Circuit told us this is unconstitutional. We're just going to stop. They could also, as I mentioned earlier, say, you know what? If you've got a membership card, good enough, right? That's good enough for us. But this wrangling, I think, is just going to this sort of broader strategic posture that they've taken to say that, look, you know what, unless you're a certified class, we're going to treat you like you don't matter, you know. Yeah. And I think that's disappointing, to say the least.
Absolutely. And as you say, that's not just in Second Amendment cases, but across the board, including Second Amendment cases. And of course, you know, that would have, to put it lightly, that would have a chilling effect on the work that FPC does, that SAF does, that all of the litigation efforts, right, to claw back our Second Amendment rights, where they've been lost at either the state or federal level.
Well, I think this is just kind of the collateral damage. You know, if you don't want to fight a rear guard, you know, 4-year term as president, you know, the first thing you do is bomb the runways. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing here, is them saying like, okay, we're done with this, and we don't care what happens, why, you know, who's affected, unfortunately. So yeah, we'll keep working on this. I don't think that there's anything, you know, in terms of this particular case, nothing that we didn't expect. We did expect this fight. What was unfortunate was just where the judge went with it and how the judge, you know, made those decisions. But I think ultimately, yeah, you know, we saw this fight coming in Elite Precision. We saw this fight coming in, we have this, we're going to have the same issue with the post office case, you know, the post office carry case. So this is just going to be what happens when you sue the federal government, I think, until the Supreme Court says, here's what we're doing.
All right. Well, I know that those lawsuits are going to continue to be filed from FPC. And I appreciate, again, you joining us on the program, Brandon. It's always good talking with you. And I look forward to having you back again very soon, because I'm sure there's going to be something new to talk about.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Brandon. My thanks to Brandon for joining us on the program. And I'm looking forward to having him back again very soon. And it will not be long. FPC very active in the litigation space. All right. Let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day. And our recidivist report, we'll start there with a case out of Baltimore. Police detail what led to arrest in shooting outside of school. The shooting took place back in March. The arrest was not made until Monday of this week. 18-year-old Chala Haywood, charged with first-degree murder, being held without bond. Police say that he chased a teenage victim to a school and then used two firearms to shoot and kill him. According to WBAL in Baltimore, a bail review hearing was postponed yesterday because Haywood is in Baltimore City Jail for violating his probation on a separate charge of illegally possessing a firearm. 16-year-old Kamau Campbell was shot at a shopping center there in Baltimore. He then ran to this school where he collapsed and was shot again multiple times. Campbell ultimately passed away to a hospital. Haywood was on probation at the time of that shooting, according to police. So again, here's the question. And I know Fox News ran a big story yesterday. I think my colleague Tom Knight may have even written about this at Bearing Arms about Ivan Bates, the state's attorney there in Baltimore, crediting his efforts to go after repeat violent offenders, hold them without bond, make sure that they are getting, you know, as much prison time as possible. He's crediting his program for dramatically reducing violent crime and homicides in Baltimore. And I'm sure that actually has something to do with it, because, again, we are talking about a small number of individuals who are responsible for an outsized portion of violent crime. But I just can't help but notice that in this case, you've got somebody who, 18 years old now, I don't know if he was 18 at the time of his conviction for illegally possessing a firearm. I have a feeling that he was a juvenile at that time. And again, a slap on the wrist for illegally possessing that firearm, sentenced to probation, little to no jail time whatsoever. Easily able to legally acquire multiple firearms, according to police, right? And then allegedly use them in the commission of a homicide, which does, again, beg the question of, okay, what's happening in the juvenile justice system in Maryland? Because we've seen cases before where individuals as young as 12, 13 years old are committing armed robberies. They're being released to their parents. And any sort of punishment that they receive from a juvenile court, you know, very limited in scope. It's not like they're being held until they turn 21. Oftentimes, there is no detention whatsoever after they've been convicted or pled guilty to a violent criminal offense. So I'm glad to see the progress that's being made in Baltimore. It is significant. And after nearly a decade where every year Baltimore had over 300 homicides, it's a significant improvement. But I think there's still a long way to go before the criminal justice system in the state of Maryland treats violent offenders as tough as they treat lawful gun owners. And certainly there's a long way to go before lawmakers in Maryland treat violent offenders as tough as they treat lawful gun owners in the state. On to today's armed citizen story, which actually is a little different than what we normally talk about. So just ran across this headline this morning. Self-defense law applies to bedrooms, Arizona Supreme Court says. So this case does not involve a firearm. It actually involves a microphone stand. There was a guy named John Brown. Lives in Pima County. He was found guilty of attacking a neighbor with a microphone stand after the neighbor and his girlfriend entered his room. Brown lived with the guy's girlfriend, but apparently the two had separate rooms. His girlfriend had invited the neighbor, who was someone that Brown had previously gotten in a fight with, over to the house. Brown said, "I don't want to be here. I don't like this guy." He left him alone, went to his bedroom, locked the door. His girlfriend then broke open the lock for some stupid reason. And then the neighbor tried to enter Brown's bedroom, which is when Brown attacked him. At trial, Brown asked that the jury be taught about state law that allows a person to claim self-defense if they attack someone entering their residential structure uninvited. But the judge denied that request, saying that his bedroom was not a residential structure, that the neighbor had been invited over by another person living in the home. So he was found guilty. He was convicted, sentenced to 5 years in prison. John Brown appealed that ruling. He lost the appeal, and then he asked the Arizona Supreme Court to review the case. According to, I believe this is the Arizona Republic, five out of the six justices disagreed with the lower court's decision not to let the jury consider the residential self-defense argument. Justice James Bean, writing for the majority of the Arizona Supreme Court, said that the way that the state law is written, Brown's bedroom should have been considered a residential structure in and of itself. According to the justices, there are three things that make any space a legally recognized residential structure. It has to be a structure, movable or immovable, permanent or temporary, and adapted for human residence. It should be enclosed, have sides in a floor. It must be a place for lodging, because it's, again, it's a residence, right? So you got to be able to sleep there. Also has to be separately securable, meaning that the entry point can be locked or secured. And in this case, John Brown's bedroom door had its own lock. And the judge said his room fits all of those points. He locked the door, and it can be said that any person breaking into that room was, in fact, uninvited. So they vacated Brown's verdict. They send the case back to Pima County Superior Court for a new trial. I suspect if the jury is allowed to consider this law, that Mr. Brown is not going to get convicted, but we'll see what happens. In fact, we'll see if prosecutors even recharge Brown with assault after the Supreme Court's ruling. But to me, this makes perfect sense. You know, there are a lot of people who may live in a, you know, single family home or even a multi-bedroom apartment or condo with roommates, not necessarily family members, but with roommates. Or even, but even if we're talking about a family member, let's say your brother, your sister, your mom or dad, your grandparents, whoever, your son or daughter invites somebody over to the house that you don't like, that you've had problems with in the past. You say, I want to remove myself from the situation altogether. And yet that person does not allow you to do so because they break in through the door of your bedroom. Do you have a right to protect yourself in those circumstances? I would argue that yes, you do. Now, again, in this case, John Brown did not use lethal force. It sounds like he didn't believe maybe his life was in danger at that point, but he wanted this individual to get out of his space. And under Arizona law, he was allowed to use force to do that. So I think the Arizona Supreme Court made the right call here. I don't know how broadly applicable this is going to be, but, you know, again, given the number of people who, again, have roommates who live with family members, I'm guessing that number is not going to be zero. So we'll keep our eyes open for any news out of Pima County as to whether or not they're going to recharge John Brown in this case. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time. Willing and able to do the right thing down in the Lone Star State of Texas. A Sam Houston student saving a man from choking at a restaurant in Moss Bluff, Texas. The student in question, and by the way, this is a Sam Houston High School, not Sam Houston State University. And I apologize, this is not actually Texas. This is Moss Bluff, Louisiana. I had no idea that Louisiana honored Sam Houston just like the Lone Star State of Texas did. Anyway, my apologies to the state of Louisiana. And Madison Bridles, who is the student in question, she said she was hanging up Halloween decorations at a restaurant called the Bouton when a customer stood up in their seat and gave her the universal signal for, I'm choking. She said, I rushed over to him. I gave him the Heimlich maneuver. Right after that, I patted his back. I went to the back, and I finished my shift. The high school student says it's not even the first time she's actually had to use the Heimlich maneuver to save somebody. She says she's also performed the Heimlich maneuver on her dad. She says, I was never really properly taught. The first time I did it was when my dad was choking on his own throw-up. He kind of walked me through it when he was choking. And she said, I just kind of put that into action last Wednesday night. One of her coworkers, Grace Arden, says, I was hanging up decorations with her as my table. She said, I'm just like so proud of her because I had no idea what to do. I was looking around to see if anybody like knew the Heimlich or anything, and she just jumped into action really fast. Bridal says she does not see herself as a hero. She says it was just a natural reaction. She says, if it was anybody, I would have done it to anybody, like honestly. Well, like honestly, Bridles, Ms. Bridles, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. That's something very important, and you fit the bill in all of those circumstances. So you may not call yourself a hero, but you definitely performed a good deed. Madison Bridles there in Moss Bluff, Louisiana. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com, though in the meantime, keeping up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, including the red flag referendum in Maine, where the gun control lobby is spending big. We've got more news out of Minnesota, where Governor Tim Walz apparently is not going to call for a special session, at least not this week, even though he said he was, and a whole lot more. If you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Great savings going on right now. Use the promo code POTUS47, and you can get 74% off your VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum membership while the government shutdown is in effect. You've got great benefits at every tier of support, and again, we certainly appreciate your support no matter which level you choose. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. Be great.